After lobbying successfully for deregulation of electricity markets in several states, among them California, it began a campaign to deregulate the trading of energy futures. In the early 1990s, it and several other energy companies sought to exempt themselves from the Commodity Exchange Act's requirement that energy traders disclose information about their futures contracts to the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, CFTC, the agency responsible for enforcing the act. Just over a week after Bill Clinton had defeated George Bush in the November 7, 1992 election, the companies petitioned the CFTC, headed at the time by Wendy Graham, to remove energy futures trading from its jurisdiction. Graham, by that time a lame duck, as were the other Bush appointees on the commission, was also potentially in a conflict of interest. Her husband, Texan Senator Phil Graham, was a leading beneficiary of Enron's political largesse. She nonetheless brought the petition before her commission, which in January 1993 decided, by a vote of 2-1, in favor of Enron and the other petitioners. As a result, trading in energy futures was no longer subject to CFTC oversight. "It sets a dangerous precedent," Sheila Blair, the lone dissenter on the commission, said of the decision at the time. "It was the most irresponsible decision I have come across," said Congressman Glenn English, an 18-year veteran of the House and chair of the House subcommittee that governed Graham's commission. 6 days after she handed down her decision, on the day Bill Clinton took office, Wendy Graham resigned from the commission. 5 weeks later, she was appointed to Enron's board of directors. Though freed from CFTC scrutiny by the Graham Commission decision, energy traders were still legally required to conduct trades in regulated auctions, such as on the New York Mercantile Exchange. Because these auctions reported prices, volumes, and other information to regulators, traders such as Enron remained under the watch of regulators. Enron attacked this problem head-on in 1999 by spending more than $1 million to lobby for repeal of the regulated auction requirement. It was a tough challenge for the company. The President's Working Group on Financial Markets had only recently decided that energy futures trading should remain in regulated markets because supply and price manipulation would almost certainly occur if it did not. Enron persisted, however. It poured even more money into lobbying and got further assistance from its friend, Senator Graham, who introduced the Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000. Which would repeal the regulated auction requirement. The then chairman of the New York Mercantile Exchange, Daniel Rappaport, remarked at the time that if this bill ever saw the light of day with full floor debate, it wouldn't have a chance to survive. The bill languished in the Senate, but then was passed by Congress, attached to an appropriations bill, after Senator Graham reintroduced it under a different number and name. It was signed into law by then lame duck President Clinton on December 21, 2000. Enron had won. It could now run its own auctions on its own trading floor, hidden from governmental scrutiny and the public view. It took full advantage of its new freedom by targeting California's energy markets for manipulation. In a series of brilliantly diabolical schemes, whose sinister character is best captured by Enron insiders' nicknames for them, Death Star, Get Shorty, and Fat Boy, the company helped manufacture an artificial energy shortage that drove the price of electricity and consequently its profits sky high. 38 blackouts plagued California over the 6 months after the Commodity Futures Modernization Act was signed by the president. Up until that point, and from the beginning of the energy crisis in May 2000, only one blackout had occurred. As Ralph Nader's public citizen organization concluded, Phil Gramm's commodities deregulation law allowed Enron to control electricity in California, pocket billions in extra revenues, and force millions of California residents to go hundreds of hours without electricity and pay outrageous prices. On June 19, 2001, the crisis was brought to an end when the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission imposed strict price controls on California's electricity markets. Spot prices fell by more than 80%, and Enron, which had bet on prices remaining high, having had no reason to believe its manipulation of markets would be stopped, was left with billions of dollars of contracts now worth a fraction of what it had paid for them. The company began to bleed. Losses piled up. CEO Jeff Skilling quit abruptly very soon after the price controls were put in place, and Enron filed for bankruptcy 4 months later. Though numerous factors can be blamed for Enron's collapse, the losses it suffered as a result of its misdeeds in California rank high among them. Enron may have been unique for the tactical brilliance it deployed in seeking to remove government oversight of its operations by influencing the political process. It was not unique, however, in using such a strategy. Though often accused of corrupting democracy with their money and influence, corporations have little choice but to seek influence when that is necessary for protecting and promoting their interests. Because regulations reduce profitability, strategies to remove them make good business sense. The executive, who, out of principled concern for the integrity of the democratic process, refuses to be involved in political influence, fails his or her shareholders, as well as the corporation's legal mandate to promote its best interests. The job of a corporate executive is not to protect democracy, but to manage its uncertainties and avoid the obstacles it presents. Ann Wexler is one of Washington, D.C.'s top lobbyists, with a client list that includes major corporations such as American Airlines, General Motors, and Roche, and an extensive network of contacts from her days at the helm of Bill Clinton's Office of Public Liaison. She was still gloating over a recent victory for one of her clients when we caught up with her for an interview. "Last night," she said, "the amendment which would have raised the fuel efficiency standard was defeated in the House. That was a victory for the automobile industry, including our client." The industry feared the amendment would restrict the production of highly profitable gas-guzzling sport utility vehicles and spent millions of dollars to help defeat it. Its lobby against the amendment was typical of corporate lobbying more generally. When corporations lobby governments, their usual goal is to avoid regulation. Sometimes they seek to stop governments from introducing new or stronger regulations, as the auto industry did with the fuel efficiency standard. Other times, they pressure governments to repeal, weaken, or narrow the scope of existing regulations, as Enron did with the regulation of energy futures trading. Corporations lobby government, in other words, primarily for defensive purposes, as Cato Institute Chairman William Niskanen states, largely in response to threats to their independence by government in the form of regulation. Corporations began to take that threat seriously in the early 1970s. By then, it was clear that the onslaught of regulation created over the previous decade, the New Social Regulation, as it was called, composed of environmental, human rights, and workers' and consumers' safety regimes, had substantially curbed their freedoms and powers, much as the New Deal had previously done. And though corporations had stood by idly during the 1960s and watched public opinion and political momentum turn against them, they now knew it was time to fight back. No coup was plotted this time. Instead, with a new awareness that so many of the decisions that are made here in Washington, D.C., go directly to the bottom line, as lobbyist Wexler describes it, corporations began to mobilize politically. They set up offices in Washington, D.C., and created industry organizations, lobby groups, and industry-backed think tanks to assert their collective influence. The Business Roundtable, a highly influential association of top CEOs, was established in 1972 out of a belief among corporate heads that the business sector in a pluralistic society should play an active and effective role in the formation of public policy, and that it was necessary to ensure that there would be less unwarranted intrusion by government into business affairs. Business-government relations have undergone profound changes since the early 1970s, a time when, as Niskanen describes it, only relatively few corporations had much of a public role in federal politics, and most corporations did not have offices in Washington, did not have lobbyists here. Today, all major corporations have offices in the nation's capital, as do the numerous industry groups, think tanks, and lobby organizations that represent their collective interests. Another significant change in corporate government relations since the 1970s has been the expanded role and influence of corporate donations within the electoral system. In the mid-1970s, the Supreme Court extended First Amendment constitutional protection to corporate financing of elections, a decision that opened the door to corporations' near-complete takeover of the electoral process. The logic of corporate election financing is clear. As Aristotle noted in Politics, when money has been spent to get office, the purchasers may naturally be expected to fall into the habit of trying to make a profit on the transaction. Or, as Anne Wexler puts it, it's very hard for a politician to turn somebody down when they've given $100,000 to his or her campaign. In terms of getting in the door and making your case, it's obviously easier. Corporate donations now fuel the political system and are a core strategy in businesses' campaign to influence government. To cite just a few examples, the coal industry gave roughly $1.5 million to political campaigns, with $1.3 million, 84%, of that going to Republicans during the 2002 election cycle alone. Since 1990, the industry has spent close to $11 million on political contributions, with $8.4 million, 77%, going to Republicans, which may help explain why the Bush administration seems so determined to cut the MSHA's budget. Corporations that contributed money to the GOP and Republican candidates were granted significant access to the Cheney Task Force, created by President Bush in 2002 to formulate a national energy policy. Enron gave more than $2 million between 1999 and 2002 and got four contacts with the task force. Southern Company gave more than $1.5 million and got seven contacts. Exelon Corporation gave close to $1 million and got six contacts, and so on. Heavy contributors received other kinds of benefits as well. Chevron, for example, proposed relaxation of regulations governing the granting of federal permits to develop energy projects and those relating to fuel supply. Its proposals were adopted in their entirety. In 1999, Jim Nicholson, chairman of the GOP at the time, wrote to Charles Heimbold Jr., CEO of pharmaceutical company Bristol-Myers Squibb, asking for a $250,000 donation and stating, among other things, that we must keep the lines of communication open if we want to keep passing legislation that will benefit your industry. After donating more than $1 million to congressional candidates, most of them Republicans, during the 2001 election cycle, Eli Lilly and Company found itself the beneficiary of a provision buried in the Homeland Security Act that protected thimerosal manufacturers, of which it is the only one, from lawsuits arising out of harm caused by the drug's use. Thimerosal is a mercury-based preservative used in children's vaccines that may be linked to the development of autism in children. The provision was eventually removed in response to public indignation and political pressure. Whether through lobbying, political donations, or public relations campaigns, corporations seek to influence the democratic process for much the same reason the anti-Roosevelt plotters sought to destroy it. They want to ensure that governments do not restrict their freedoms and frustrate their self-interested missions. Big corporations will do whatever they believe is necessary to survive, and in some cases that means seeking special favors from the government, according to William Niskanen. The money they spend on the political process is a business expense, an investment in creating a political environment that promotes their profitability and thus helps them survive. Lacking the legal license to spend shareholders' money without a reasonable prospect of return, corporations spend money on politics for the same reason they make other investments, to advance their own and their owners' financial self-interest. From the public's perspective, however, we are, as Harvard's Joe Badaracco says, evolving towards a system where corporations have an enormous and arguably disproportionate influence on our political system. Democracy requires, at a minimum, some measure of equality of opportunity to participate in the political process. Yet profound inequality is the result when corporations, huge concentrations of shareholder wealth, exercise the same rights as individuals within that process. Today, warns Robert Monks, we face a situation of great precariousness. We are dangerously close to the co-optation of government by business. Unless we are extremely attentive to the inclination of business to dominate government, he says, it could well be that the institution of government will fade. Yet many corporate insiders seem to believe they are performing a public service when they seek to influence the political process on behalf of the companies that employ them. Educating people is how Ann Wexler describes her work as a lobbyist for major corporations. It is very difficult for a member of Congress who is a very busy person to understand what every issue is every day, she says. Our job is to be sure that the folks who are going to be making the decisions at least have an understanding of what the issues are. Chris Komisarjevsky, CEO of public relations giant Burson Marsteller, also believes his work, some of which is aimed at defeating proposed environmental and other public interest regulations on behalf of corporate clients, serves an important public purpose. What we do is based on the respect of an individual to have information put at their disposal and then make the right decision. It's the respect for the individual to make the right decision, which I believe is at the root of communications, and it is clearly at the root of the way Burson Marsteller practices its business. I don't think it's unfair at all, continues Komisarjevsky, about the claim that corporations have an unfair advantage in the political realm. Everybody has the same opportunity to garner resources to share a point of view. There are plenty of resources to help people share whatever their point of view is. Pfizer CEO Hank McKinnell similarly believes that he promotes the public good when he lobbies politicians on behalf of his company. When I lobby, I try to change government policy in a way that's a win-win for both Pfizer and the public. As for his company's political contributions, which McKinnell says are very modest, actually, these are not large amounts of money, and frankly, it's part of the way in which people participate in national policy debates. These, too, are designed to promote the public good. We hope to elect people who have supported policies which are good for the nation, he says. We want to elect people who understand the needs of the nation and are going to strive to benefit us all, who support the right kinds of policies, who can participate in the political process wisely. His political donations, he says, do not give us anything special in return. Does he believe he has undue influence over the political process? Not really. I don't feel like I have very much power at all, he says. I can try to influence the thought process and policy, but it's a very slow process. Yet, where are the desperately needed countervailing lobbies to represent the interests of average citizens? Where are the millions of dollars acting in their interests? Alas, they are notably absent. The beliefs shared by Wexler, Komisarjevsky, and McKinnell that lobbying and political donations are public services rather than undue influences over government are likely informed by a deeper belief about the proper relationship between business and government. Today, says Wexler, corporations essentially feel that they're partners with government. They're not adversaries of government. The attitude that business is a victim is basically disappearing. People understand now that government's got to be a partner, and you've got to work with them. Essentially, the business-government relationship is a symbiotic relationship. Pfizer's Hank McKinnell agrees. The key to progress in the future is partnership, he says. The best way to succeed in almost any social endeavor is in partnership. If you say this is solely the job of the federal government, or the state government, or the municipality, you're missing what's really been proven to work, which is partnerships between both the public and the private sector. The notion that business and government are and should be partners is ubiquitous, unremarkable, and repeated like a mantra by leaders in both domains. It seems a compelling and innocuous idea until you think about what it really means. Partners should be equals. One partner should not wield power over the other, should not regulate the other, should not exert sovereignty over the other. Partners should share the same mission and the same goals. They should work together to solve problems and plan courses of action. Democracy, on the other hand, is necessarily hierarchical. It requires that the people, through the governments they elect, have sovereignty over corporations, not equality with them. That they have authority to decide what corporations can, cannot, and must do. If corporations and governments are indeed partners, we should be worried about the state of our democracy. For it means that government has effectively abdicated its sovereignty over the corporation. A partnership between big business and government is what the plotters of the 1934 coup were after. They wanted Smedley Butler, a representative of big business interests, to become Franklin Roosevelt's partner in governing the United States, a Secretary of General Affairs or Assistant President who would quickly parlay his position into dictatorial power. Today, corporations stand next to, rather than under, democratic governments, in much the same way the plotters had planned for Smedley Butler to stand next to Roosevelt. Their leaders believe they have a legitimate role as partners with government in governing society. By corollary, government is believed to have a less legitimate role in governing corporations. As stewards of the public interest, along with their government partners, corporations should be left free to regulate themselves. Or at least, that is the argument made by proponents of deregulation. While some regulation is necessary to ensure that certain standards, minimal standards, are maintained, says Pfizer's Hank McKinnell, in most cases, best practices in industry are well ahead of government regulation. And in fact, we have many examples of where excessive regulation has damaged industry. Corporations can regulate themselves now, according to Douglas G. Pinkham, president of the Washington, D.C.-based Public Affairs Council, and should be given the freedom to deal with a concern, such as workers or the environment, in a constructive way that maybe doesn't involve government regulation, to create a voluntary code. In a similar spirit, BP's John Brown complains that there is still something of a belief that solutions lie fundamentally in regulation and control in Europe, and that even in the United States, a majority of people, according to one survey, believe that companies needed regulation and could not be trusted to manage their own activities responsibly. Today, regulations, central control, is not the direction people are going, says fellow oilman Jim Gray. We have to be responsible at the other end, we in business, not to take advantage of circumstances. Yet business is all about taking advantage of circumstances. Corporate social responsibility is an oxymoron, I argued earlier, as is the related notion that corporations can, like their government counterparts, be relied upon to promote the public interest. Corporations have only one duty, to promote their own and their owners' interests. They have no capacity and their executives no authority to act out of a genuine sense of responsibility to society, to avoid causing harm to people and the environment, or to work to advance the public good in ways that are unrelated to their own self-interest. Deregulation thus rests upon the suspect premise that corporations will respect social and environmental interests without being compelled by government to do so. No one would seriously suggest that individuals should regulate themselves, that laws against murder, assault, and theft are unnecessary because people are socially responsible. Yet, oddly, we are asked to believe that corporate persons, institutional psychopaths who lack any sense of moral conviction and who have the power and motivation to cause harm and devastation in the world should be left free to govern themselves. Chapter 5. Corporations Unlimited. It was one of the worst things I've seen in my lifetime. Carlton Brown, a normally unflappable commodities broker, was deeply troubled by what he had seen on September 11, 2001. All I could think about was getting them the hell out, he says. Before the building collapsed, all we were thinking was, let's get those clients out. Out of the gold market, that is. Brown was mainly concerned about clients who might get trapped in the gold market, which he knew would close once the World Trade Center towers collapsed. When the airplanes hit the towers, said Brown, the first thing you thought about was, well, how much is gold up? Fortunately, he says, in the next couple of days we got them all out. Everybody doubled their money. September 11th was a blessing in disguise. Devastating, you know, crushing, heart-shattering. But for my clients that were in the gold market, they all made money, he says. In devastation, there's opportunity. It's all about creating wealth. The corporation, too, is all about creating wealth, and it is a highly effective vehicle for doing so. No internal limits, whether moral, ethical, or legal, limit what or whom corporations can exploit to create wealth for themselves and their owners. To exploit, according to the dictionary, is to use for one's own selfish ends or profit, the New Lexicon, Webster's Encyclopedia Dictionary of the English Language. Over the last century and a half, the corporation has sought and gained rights to exploit most of the world's natural resources and almost all areas of human endeavor. As early as 1932, Adolf Burl and Gardner Means observed in The Modern Corporation and Private Property. Following the lead of the railroads in the last part of the 19th century and the early years of the 20th, one aspect of economic life after another has come under corporate sway. In field after field, the corporation has entered, grown, and become wholly or partially dominant. On the basis of its development in the past, we may look forward to a time when practically all economic activity will be carried on under the corporate form. That time has come. Today, practically all economic activity is carried on under the corporate form. One large barrier remains, however, to corporations being in control of everything: the public sphere. The 20th century was unique in modern history for the widely held belief that democracy required governments to protect citizens' social rights and meet their fundamental needs. Essential public interests and social domains believed to be too precious, vulnerable, or morally sacred to subject to corporate exploitation were inscribed by law and public policy within protective boundaries. Human beings could not be owned, and children could not be exploited, either as workers or as consumers. Institutions essential to human health and survival, such as water utilities and health and welfare services, human progress and development, such as schools, universities, and cultural institutions, and public safety, such as police, courts, prisons, and firefighters, were deliberately placed beyond the corporation's exploitative grasp, as were precious natural domains, which were turned into parks and nature reserves. The resulting public sphere, which exists to greater and lesser degrees in all modern nations, is now under attack. Historically, corporations have been hostile to it, as, from their perspective, it is little more than a collection of unwarranted exclusions from vast profit-making opportunities. Particularly over the last two decades, they have waged a determined campaign to push back its exclusionary boundaries. Through a process known as privatization, governments have capitulated and handed over to corporations control of institutions once thought to be inherently public in nature. No part of the public sphere has been immune to the infiltration of for-profit corporations. Water and power utilities, police, fire and emergency services, daycare centers, welfare services, social security, colleges and universities, research, prisons, airports, health care, genes, broadcasting, the electromagnetic spectrum, public parks and highways have all, depending on the jurisdiction, undergone or are being considered for full or partial privatization. As a result, we are moving toward a new kind of society, one that eventually could look similar to the model proposed by privatization advocates, such as economist Milton Friedman, who recommends that only 10-12% of total income, compared to what he estimates as 40-50% in the United States today, should come from government. Nothing but the most basic functions, the judicial system, the armed forces, and relief of the most extreme cases of poverty, Friedman says, should be within government's control. The private area would be much larger, he says, and it would be run largely by private for-profit enterprises. Many economists and policymakers agree with Friedman. Cato Institute Chairman William Niskanen, for example, believes that there are very few functions. The only one he could think of was the military, that should remain in the public sphere. And Michael Walker, an economist who heads the Fraser Institute, Cato's Canadian partner, responded with an enthusiastic, "Absolutely!" when asked whether he believed every square inch of the planet should be under private control. Such views may yet prevail, and in the not-too-distant future, the public sphere could be reduced to a quaint historical anomaly. The classic investment opportunity is where there's a problem, according to investment banker Michael Moe. The larger the problem, the larger the opportunity. And there's no larger problem today, and hence no larger investment opportunity, than how to better educate our populace. Inspired by that belief, Moe helped raise more than $500 million to finance Edison Schools, a publicly traded for-profit company that operates schools on behalf of local governments and plans eventually to own and run its own schools. Edison Schools is the largest education management organization, EMO, in the United States, with 133 schools and 74,000 students currently under its control. It, along with roughly 40 other EMO corporations, reflects a growing trend in the United States toward privatization of kindergarten through 12th grade, K-12 education. Because the education market combines a large problem with a small corporate presence, says Moe, it is poised, much as healthcare was 30 years ago, to expand rapidly in the coming years. The industry is in the first inning of a 9-inning game that could go into extra innings, he says. In 2001 alone, for example, the number of EMOs in the United States increased by 70%. Conservatively, Moe estimates, 10% of the $800 billion education industry will be run by for-profit corporations in 10 years' time, compared to 1% today. Government, much like other businesses, he says, now wants to outsource its operations, and it is likely in coming years to transform its role in education from an owner-operator of schools to be more of a general contractor. Milton Friedman agrees. I've been involved in this movement now for 45 years, he says of his advocacy of privatized schools. And it's in the last 5 years or so that we've really started to break the ice jam and get moving. In the not-too-distant future, he predicts, corporations like Edison Schools will develop into enterprises that will run their own private schools rather than just operating government-owned schools. No doubt, huge opportunities await corporations such as Edison Schools that manage to infiltrate K-12 education in any significant way. It's almost unimaginably vast, says Edison chairman Benno Schmidt Jr., of the potential for growth in the industry. Education is bigger than defense, bigger than the whole domestic auto industry. In fact, only healthcare has a larger segment of the American marketplace. In other countries, too, there are potentially bright futures for corporate schools, adds Moe, who cites Canada and the United Kingdom as just two examples of the many countries around the world that are turning more toward market-driven mechanisms to reform their education systems. Backers of for-profit schools have used political muscle to promote the growth of their industry. Two of Edison's largest investors, Boston financier John Childs and Gap chairman Donald Fisher, recently donated $670,000 and $260,800, respectively, to the Republicans. They must have been pleased when President Bush pledged $3 billion in federal loans to fund new charter schools and subsidize students who wish to attend private schools, policy changes that will expand the markets for EMOs. Other big money supporters of Bush also have major stakes in the education industry. Leading businessmen, such as Amway founder Richard DeVoe, industrialist David Brennan, and Walmart's John Walton, have supported Bush and spent millions of dollars promoting state voucher systems, which will create lucrative markets for EMOs once they're adopted. Despite their enthusiasm for privatized schools, proponents have no solid evidence to support their claims that such schools perform better in terms of children's learning outcomes than comparable public schools. Indeed, Edison's claims to that effect have been questioned by independent researchers at Western Michigan University, who found that Edison students do not perform as well as Edison claims in its annual reports on student performance. The company has been criticized for other alleged exaggerations, such as inflating the numbers of schools it runs by counting each of the K-5, 6-8, and 9-12 grade divisions as separate schools in settings where they are actually all administered by one principal and housed in one building. But that is not the worst of Edison's troubles. Recently, shares in Edison schools, which had reached a high of $21.68 on the NASDAQ stock exchange, plummeted to less than $1. To save money in running its Philadelphia schools, the company sold off textbooks, computers, lab supplies, and musical instruments. It also moved its executives into schoolrooms in the hope of saving $9,000 a month in rent on their corporate offices. Upon learning about the move, the school board quickly ordered the executives out of the schools. Edison founder and CEO Chris Whittle further proposed that the company use unpaid Edison students to do the work of paid school employees. "We could have less adult staff," he is reported to have told a group of Edison principals as he described his plan to have each of 600 students in a school work 1 hour a day at administrative tasks, thus making the work of 75 adults redundant. Proponents defend the privatization of schools and privatization more generally as theoretically correct, even while in the real world it often goes awry. Playing on people's self-interest in material gain, they say, echoing the premise of laissez-faire economic theory, is the surest route to promoting the public good. "People tend to react to economic incentives as a reason to do things," says Edison Schools financier Jeffrey Frum, explaining why he thinks for-profit schools should outperform their public counterparts. "Motivated by a desire to make money, teachers in for-profit schools will teach better, administrators will administer better, and corporations will provide their customers, parents, teachers, school boards, with what they want and need. Therefore," says Fromm, "the for-profit incentive can have a positive impact on schools, even though corporations have to think, really, only about one bottom line. Corporations can provide the ability for change to be infused into the educational system," he believes, "because the Darwinism among business in a capitalist economy, if unleashed on the education system, will tend to produce better education in the U.S. Privatization thus makes the most of our inevitably selfish and materialist nature. "We owe our daily bread not to the benevolence of the baker, but to his concern for his own interest," is how Milton Friedman, paraphrasing Adam Smith, explains the virtues of privatization. By corollary, public institutions are inherently flawed, according to Friedman and other privatization proponents, because they rely on an unrealistic, that is, not entirely selfish and materialistic, concept of human nature. "The big difference," Friedman told me when I asked him what separated his views from John Kenneth Galbraith's, "is whether you are really willing to accept the idea that civil servants are pursuing the interest of the community at large, rather than their own self-interest. That's the big divide. That's the divide between Galbraith and myself." Though privatized services might, by some measures and in some contexts, prove more effective than public ones, privatization is flawed as a general and long-term solution to society's problems. Philosophically, it rests upon a distorted and incomplete conception of human nature. Self-interest and materialistic desire are parts of who we are, but not all. To base a social and economic system on these traits is dangerously fundamentalist. On a more practical level, privatization is flawed for its reliance on for-profit corporations to deliver the public good. Unlike public institutions, whose only legitimate mandate is to serve the public good, corporations are legally required always to put their own interests above everyone else's. They may act in ways that promote the public good when it is to their advantage to do so, but they will just as quickly sacrifice it, it is their legal obligation to do so, when necessary to serve their own ends. No doubt privatization opens up new areas for corporations to exploit for profit, which is why they zealously promote it. From the public standpoint, however, we have to ask what kind of society we create when we put corporations in charge of the very sinews of our society, the institutions that define who we are, that bind us together, and that enable us to survive and live securely. These concerns are not confined to privatization, however. They also extend to a closely related, though less formal process, the commercialization of society, which also involves corporations infiltrating areas of society from which, until recently, they were excluded. The annual Vancouver Children's Festival was once a respite from commercialism. So I was taken aback when, on a recent visit to the festival with my son, we found ourselves in the middle of a mock Kia car dealership after entering the grounds through the main gate. Shiny new vehicles were seductively positioned on the grass, banners with Kia logos fluttered in the breeze, and chippy young Kia staff roamed the grounds giving away free stuff to kids. The festival had permitted the display in exchange for Kia's sponsorship dollars. My son wanted to play on the cars, and I had to pry him away so we could attend a concert by children's performer Raffi, a concert, it turned out, that would never happen. Raffi, appalled, he told me later, by what appeared to be a car dealership on the festival grounds, refused to play and withdrew from the festival. I was just completely floored by this corporate visibility, this gross commercialization, he said. It was distressing to the max for me, and I didn't feel I could perform in that environment. So, at my son's insistence, we went back to the cars, where he nagged me persistently to buy him an SUV, but settled for an inflatable dinosaur with a Kia logo on it. Then, during the National Hockey League Stanley Cup playoffs, my son nagged me again, this time to buy him a 24-pack of Labatt Blue beer. He absolutely had to have the plastic Stanley Cup replica that came with the 24-pack, a promotion he had learned about from an advertisement run frequently during the games. Labatt must have known that young children would be watching the Stanley Cup playoffs with their parents. It's a national ritual in Canada, and also that most adults would not be enticed to abandon their preferred brand of beer to obtain a plastic Stanley Cup replica. Therefore, it seems reasonable to assume that part of the company's aim was to get my son to get me to buy its beer, which it did. In buying that beer and being nagged to buy the Kia SUV, I was an unwitting victim of the nag factor, a brilliant new marketing strategy that takes manipulation of children to the extreme. Lucy Hughes, who serves as Director of Strategy and Insight for Initiative Media, the world's largest communications management company, is one of the creators of the nag factor, a solution to a problem that has vexed marketers for years. How can money be extracted from young children who want to buy products but have no money of their own? Though you can manipulate consumers into wanting and therefore buying your products, says Hughes, young children present unique challenges. For them, she realized several years ago, and this is the crucial insight behind the nag factor, advertisements must be aimed not at getting them to buy things, but at getting them to nag their parents to buy things. To that end, Hughes and her colleagues at Initiative Media, with the help of child psychologists, developed a scientific breakdown of different kinds of nags that children use and the differential impacts they have on different kinds of parents. We found that the way a child nags isn't always the same, that there's one of two ways, that they nag either with persistence or they nag with importance. When we talk about nagging with persistence, it's really whiny. Mommy, I really, really want the Barbie dream house. Wah, 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 wah. Nagging with importance is that the child has associated some sort of importance to this product. Mommy, I need the Barbie dream house so Barbie and Ken can live together and have children and have their own family. The way the child nags to the parent will have an impact on whether or not the parent will buy that product. The effectiveness of each kind of nag depends upon which of four types of parents is the target. Bare necessities parents, one of the largest groups, tend to be affluent and upscale, but unresponsive to a child's whining. They want a good reason for buying something for their child. So, says Hughes, we will try to get the kids to nag them with importance, to show them the value or benefit this product has to them, why it's important to the child, and in the right circumstances, the parent will be receptive to it. The other three groups of parents may be more susceptible to persistent whining. The smallest group, kids' pals, tend to be younger parents who buy products such as computer games and remote-control toy trucks for themselves as much as for their kids. Indulgers are working moms who buy things for their children to ease their guilt about not spending enough time with them. Conflicted parents, usually single moms, feel they shouldn't be buying frivolous things for their children, but do so anyway. They say they don't like impulse buying, but they do it anyway. And they oppose advertising aimed at their children, but welcome its assistance in helping them decide what to buy for them. The fate of entire corporate empires could depend upon marketers' abilities to get children to nag their parents effectively. With McDonald's, for example, says Hughes, parents wouldn't be going there unless their child nags. Chuck E. Cheese's? Oh my goodness, says Hughes. It's noisy, and there's so many kids. Why would I want to spend 2 hours there? Hughes, who says her company wanted to be the first to actually quantify the impact of children's nagging, found that anywhere from 20% to 40% of purchases would not have occurred unless the child had nagged their parents. We found, for example, a quarter of all visits to theme parks wouldn't have occurred unless a child nagged their parents. 4 out of 10 visits to places like Chuck E. Cheese's would not have occurred. We saw the same thing with movies, with home video, with fast food. Children's influence on what products the parents are buying is huge. Children's influence extends well beyond children's products, even to high-end adult items such as cars. There are, says Hughes, many features in a car that really do appeal to kids, which explains Kia's marketing efforts at the Vancouver Children's Festival, as well as its tie-in deals with blockbuster kid videos such as The Lord of the Rings, a deal that, according to Kia, is designed to build showroom traffic by leveraging the highly anticipated VHS-DVD release of the popular film, and Shrek. Kia is not alone in targeting children, however. Nissan sponsors the American Youth Soccer Organization. Chrysler uses glossy, kid-friendly pop-up books in direct mailing campaigns, and increasingly, kids are prominently featured in the car advertisements of all companies. From a marketing point of view, it's pretty powerful stuff, says marketer Julie Halpin of the trend toward harnessing children's influence to sell adult products. The toy and candy manufacturers have always been there and always will be. But we have a financial services client Whoever thought a kid agency would have a financial services client? Indeed. Kids are amazing when they watch TV, marvels Hughes. They're paying attention to the advertising. How many people actually pay attention to the advertising? Among parents, it's probably quite thin, quite small. Targeting children makes a lot of sense from a marketing perspective, as it allows advertisers to bypass media-savvy parents and engage the considerable persuasive power children wield over their parents. Children are also easier to manipulate than adults. Lucy Hughes and her industry colleagues would likely agree with the experts that young children are particularly susceptible to media manipulation. That, as the American Academy of Pediatrics states, young children under 8 years of age developmentally are unable to understand the intent of advertisements and, in fact, accept advertising claims as true. Indeed, the youngest viewers up to age 8 cannot distinguish advertising from regular television programming. For marketers and the corporations they work for, children's susceptibility to advertising is exactly what makes them such appealing targets. Within the psychopathic world of the corporation, vulnerability is an invitation to exploit, not a reason to protect. Children, as tomorrow's consumers, represent a huge market today, and therefore are fair game for corporations, says Lucy Hughes. Or, as another advertising executive puts it, they aren't children so much as what we like to call evolving consumers. Is it ethical? I don't know, Hughes says of her work, but then quickly states